The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, we're going to start. I should say continue. I think we can still say good morning because we're still in the morning. My name is Bob Dinnerstein, and I'll be moderating this panel. We have such a good panel with so many great people that I'm not going to say much except to call on people and introduce them at the beginning. The only thing I did want to say is that since this panel is about implementation through domestic law, policy, and practice, that as we heard this morning and as we'll continue to hear, one of the challenges I think for the people here today and ultimately the challenges going forward are going to be to try to have the convention become meaningful within U.S. law and U.S. courts, policymaking entities, legislatures, et cetera. It's perhaps interesting to note that over 35 years ago, Judge Frank Johnson in the landmark case of Wyatt versus Stickney actually, in a footnote, referred to international human rights as a support for the rights of people with disabilities. He noted, and I quote, it is interesting to note that the court's decision, and this was a decision recognizing the rights of people with intellectual disabilities, with regard to the right of the mentally retarded to rehabilitation is supported not only by applicable legal authority, but also by a resolution adopted on December 27, 1971 by the General Assembly of the United Nations. That resolution, entitled Declaration on the Rights of the Mentally Retarded, reads in pertinent part, quote, the mentally retarded person has a right to proper medical care and physical therapy and to such education, training, rehabilitation, and guidance as will enable him to develop his ability and maximum potential, unquote. I cite that both because there is a long history of at least rhetorical reference to international protections, and yet, as you heard from that quote, we've come a long way. Our terminology has come a long way. Our understanding of disability is not a medical condition, but as a social interaction between individuals and society and other people is very much reflected in this convention, which we're so happy today to be able to talk about and to urge. In addition, as we heard this morning, and as I want to emphasize from my own perspective, now that the convention has been signed and on its way towards signing and ratification, and maybe by the United States someday, it's only beginning in terms of the process of actually making this a reality. Michael Lotman many years ago in a different context wrote about implementing court orders in this country for people with disabilities. Once the order is entered, now comes the hard part. So now comes the hard part. We have a very distinguished panel here today, and I'm going to introduce them very briefly at the beginning and then let them, it's not my choice to let them, they will talk for about 15 minutes each, and we'll provide an opportunity, ample opportunity for questions from the audience because you are so knowledgeable and many of you have been so involved in this process that it would be presumptuous of us to assume that that you have nothing to contribute. So we will try to take advantage of that. The first speaker is actually not directly to my left, but one past that, and that's Arlene Cantor. Arlene is, and the full bios of these folks are in your materials, so we would take the entire hour and a half if I read just what they are about. But as you do know, Arlene is co-director of the Syracuse University Center on Human Policy, Law, and Disability Studies, which is the first university-based multidisciplinary center dedicated to disability rights-related research, advocacy, policy, and public education. She also directs the law school's disability law and policy program. Following Arlene will be to my left, Kathy Martinez. Kathy is the executive director of the World Institute on Disability. Among other positions she has held or is holding, she is one of the members of the National Council on Disability, and she served as one of the eight public members on the State Department's Committee on Disability and Foreign Policy. Kathy is famous with the students in my seminar because she is on a video called My Country, which talks about people with disabilities. It's a wonderful video, and every year I show her portion of the video to my students. So if you get people, Kathy, that don't know who you are coming up to you and saying how important you've been to their lives, that's why. After Kathy, we'll be hearing from Tina Mankiewicz. Tina is the co-chairperson of the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry. She was one of 12 NGO representatives on the UN Working Group we heard about this morning that was crucial in preparing the text of this convention. Tina is going to be talking about her some particular parts of this convention that are critical, and particularly issues of individual autonomy, choice, decision-making, and supported decision-making. And then lastly, but not leastly, we will be hearing from Hadar Harris, the far left of the panel. Hadar is, as you know, you've seen her walking around and doing logistics, but in her other life, or one of her other lives, she's executive director of the Law School's Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. She has extensive experience as a human rights lawyer and advocate. I think she will be bringing to us a perspective on how other human rights instruments in this country have been implemented and adopted in the context of U.S. law to give us a perspective to look at how that might be done with respect to the Disability Convention. So without further ado, we'll start with Arlene.
Great. Well, thank you, Bob. And thank you very much to American University. We'd love to have a conference like this up in Syracuse, but I won't finish that sentence, I guess. But do come to visit, especially this time of year. I also want to thank Eric Rosenthal and MDRI for a lifetime of work, as well as the effort that he's done today with AU to bring this conference here today. I want to thank also Aaron from AU, who's been an amazing coordinator. I'd like to also thank the students who've been involved at the Syracuse University Journal of International Law and Commerce, who, as soon as I ran up to them at some point and said I had an idea, I hope they're here somewhere, began running with me to try to put together a special volume of the journal devoted to the UN Convention. And we have a wonderful assortment of authors who've contributed, many more who we wish we had, and maybe we'll do another journal volume another time, but including Don McKay, who's written a wonderful piece to set off the journal. And it'll be out soon, not in time for today, but there's information about it at the table. I also want to welcome a friend from Egypt who's visiting, a student who's spending some time with us at Syracuse, who's an architect by training, but a disability rights advocate now, recently learned, and that's Hentel Hayid, who is visiting us today as well. My task, I think, is to kind of give you an overview, what I hope will be some inspiration to follow, I thought, the incredible, specific, and thoughtful suggestions that Tara gave us at the earlier panel. I think that she really has given us food for thought, and it's a kind of hard act to follow, because if we follow her lead, we'll be there. So let me start by saying I want to define what we're talking about. What is human rights law, and how is it going to be helpful? In fact, human rights law basically can be seen as many different things. Can be seen as an inspiration, a goal, a strategy, but also a barrier. If we label certain things as human rights, and then, by some governments, including our own at times, identify them as something that's not worthy of domestic legislation. That's a problem. Traditional human rights focused only on kind of protecting rights of non-citizens against other countries interfering with their rights. But human rights today is much broader. It's much broader, it's expanded, and it's challenged. It's challenged because it's premised now not only on the notion that states have an obligation to protect non-citizens in their midst, but that states also have an obligation to protect the human rights of their own citizens. The world community has recognized this, and I think the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is one of the most significant and certainly the most recent examples of how human rights has now can become an obligation of protection by individual domestic countries. My talk's going to have three parts. I'm going to talk first about kind of what's in the convention, what's not in the convention, and then what now. So in terms of what's in the convention, we know you have it in front of you. It's a hugely expansive and comprehensive convention. It does include many of the rights that we do now have under the ADA and other discrimination laws in the United States. It looks at issues of education, of employment, of accessibility. So we can point to the IDEA, the Education for Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. We can look to the ADA Title I that prohibits discrimination in employment, and the title that prohibits discrimination in access to public services. But it also goes beyond what our laws provide in a way that can be instructive to us as disability rights advocates here in the United States. It talks about a right to work, which is arguably different than a right not to be discriminated in employment. It talks about a right to health care, which has two very important implications, I believe, for us here. First, there is no exception for people who have a label of mental disability. Under traditional law, everyone has a right to informed consent, but an exception has been carved out for people who are mentally disabled, who are perceived not to be able to give their own informed consent. The convention goes beyond this notion to recognize that all individuals have a right to make decisions about their health care decisions. Also, in terms of the health care provision, it recognizes that all individuals should have the same level of access and care to health care, regardless of whether they are individuals with disabilities or not. And as we know, currently there have been courts that have come cutting back in the United States on access to health insurance, for example, for people with disabilities. And cases have generally been unsuccessful, so that insurance companies have been permitted to differentiate and to discriminate against people based on their disability. The convention also goes beyond, in some ways, our traditional thinking about adequate standard of living. It says in the convention that all individuals should have an adequate standard of living. It talks about legal capacity, which Tina will talk about in more detail, which presumes that all individuals have the right to make decisions over their lives, and when they may need assistance, that we perhaps should not then resort to a guardianship procedure where then the state intervenes to decide who makes those decisions. Instead, in the boldest reading, the convention recognizes that individuals may get to choose people who can help them through difficult times of decision making. This is very powerful and progressive identification of what it means to have legal capacity. It recognizes family life, the right not to be discriminated against if you want to adopt a child because of the child or because of your disability. It prohibits torture, exploitation, liberty of movement is recognized, access to justice is included, personal mobility, and participation in cultural life. Notice in Title III of the ADA, which we have, individuals have the right not to be discriminated against in access to public life, public services, recreation, and cultural activities. But here the language is actual participation in cultural life. So in some significant ways, the convention has improved upon our language within the ADA. And I want to focus on two discrete examples that show us, I think, a model of how the convention can also be used to expand our thinking under U.S. law. First, the convention is the first convention, and correct me if I'm wrong, experts on international law, but my reading says it's the first convention ever adopted that marries and joins together the rights to economic and political, economic and social and cultural rights with civil and political rights. We know that we have a tradition in the international human rights arena of separating civil and political rights, which are those rights that the government can bestow, and economic and social and cultural rights, which are seen as kind of the next stage of rights. This convention is quite explicit that it joins together within its articles the economic and social and cultural rights of individuals with disabilities, as well as their rights to be protected from government interference and to be recognized as those entitled to civil and political rights within the convention. I think the convention, in my view, shows that that dichotomy between the civil and political rights, economic, social, and cultural rights has been misleading when it comes to the right of individuals to actually get up in the morning and go to work or school and live their lives day to day. It's been an artificial dichotomy that maybe has not served us well. I would also argue that substance is not only an economic right, it's also a political right. Substance does require governments to think about its role in providing health care and food and shelter to individuals. Political rights do include government intervention, and clearly a government can have a role in ensuring certain standards of living and to promote policies that provide better access to health care, food, and shelter. For decades, we know that the human rights community in the past had ignored the certain issues that had to do with people with disabilities, particularly abuses in institutions, where we know that human rights communities had been very outspoken about the right, for example, of political dissidents who were in horrible mental institutions. And yet it came time, eventually, through some of the work of Eric and others, that the people who remain in those institutions after the political dissidents had left are still living in horrible, substandard, and even conditions that result in their death. So in my view, this day is really a symbol and an opportunity to bring together those who have been advocating for the civil and political rights of people with disabilities in the United States, the human rights communities that have been working internationally to recognize civil and political, as well as economic rights of others outside of the United States, and those who are interested in focusing on economic and social rights for people generally to recognize that people with disabilities have an important voice in that process as well. What is not in the convention, I think, is also quite telling. I'm going to focus on just two quick examples. What is not in the convention, in some ways, is a limitation on the rights that courts in our country have now been recognizing. For example, in terms of community living, Article 19, if you want to follow along with me. I won't read it, if you have it in front of you. Article 19 recognizes that individuals should have choices about where they choose to live. Well, we would assume that is a human right. Article 9 also recognizes that there's no right for a treatment professional to decide whether a community placement is better than an institution, because that is currently the law in the United States. In 1999, the Supreme Court held in the Olmstead case that Title II of the ADA prohibits discrimination, and it includes a prohibition on discrimination against people with disabilities who would have to choose to go to an institution to get treatment as opposed to the community. Justice Ginsburg said that is discrimination, to make people with disabilities choose an institution, and therefore people have a right to receive community living so long as a professional makes that judgment. In the convention, there is no exception, there's no limitation that requires a professional to make a judgment about an individual's choice. That is in the convention as a right. I see Bob writing. I must have 2 minutes. The second example, and we can take questions at the end. The second example is that, and this is, and I welcome your comments on this, is that the convention does not include a definition of disability. And those of us who were involved, those of you who were involved a lot longer and more in depth than I, know that it was a subject of great debate and many ad hoc meetings. I think the seventh meeting, that's all that was discussed, was whether or not the definition of disability should be included. I see that as, maybe I'm a cup half full kind of person, but I do see that as an opportunity, not necessarily a negative at that point. Under United States law, we have a definition of disability that I would critique as not entirely a social model of disability. It still looks at whether the individual can live unless their major life activities are substantially limited. In that sense, that definition focuses on the limitations of an individual. The convention recognizes in Article 1 that people with disabilities can have long-term impairments, but in the end it is a society and the environment that disables them from realizing their full participation and opportunities. That definition, which is not a definition, it's considered in the purpose section, I think, gives us hope, and certainly is being used now in some other countries that I've been in touch with, to open up and expand definitions of disability to include groups that otherwise may not have been considered as people with disabilities, particularly children in the education setting as well. So if a convention would have a specific definition of disability, which I had hoped it would at some point, but it doesn't, so if it had a specific definition, different countries could have used it to exclude certain groups from within their protection. We are already doing that. We are excluding people based on some of the restrictive court decisions, and this may be blasphemous, but if anyone has read the Sutton decision, there was three decisions that came out also in 1999 that cut back on the definition of disability. We know that there are many people with disabilities now in the United States who are not protected by the ADA, despite our hopes and dreams originally in drafting that language. So our hope is also in this area that other countries may give us guidance about how to remove some of the limitations that court have placed on our definitions of disability. And that's clearly a strategy that disability advocates in the United States are now working on. And I think the bridge between what's happening with disability advocates in the United States looking how to overturn some of these federal court decisions or amend the ADA, work with the groups from involved in the international disability movement, have much to learn from one another. Okay, so that's kind of what's in the convention, what's not in there, and now I do have 2 minutes, and I can do that. What now? Okay, as I said, I think Tara's roadmap of what we have to do was perfect, and we should just get behind her and follow her lead. The real effect of this convention is the effect on organizing and empowering people with disabilities and their allies. The role of international law will be important for those of us who practice law and teach law as well. I don't know if you're aware, but Justice Ginsburg and Justice O'Connor had received some death threats after a speech that Justice Ginsburg made in October of 2005 and again in February 2006. She gave a speech before the Constitutional Court in South Africa, and she expressed concern about bills in the United States that were being considered that would prohibit federal courts from referring to international laws when interpreting the U.S. Constitution. She received notice from her security people after she gave the speech that there were some threats to her, quote, that the blog said, using foreign law is a, quote, huge threat to our republic and constitutional freedoms. And in response to that threat, she gave another speech which said, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, not quoting here, that the United States judicial system will be better and will be more empowered if we can look to others' experiences and, quote, learn from legal systems with values similar to our own. So with Justice Ginsburg perhaps at the lead, other courts will continue, and those of us who are lawyers writing the briefs will urge them, to begin to incorporate international law in the area of human rights, including this convention, in moving forward the rights of people with disabilities in our country. In addition to incorporating the principles of the convention in U.S. law, there are other reasons, I think, why the convention is important to our domestic policy, and that really Dick Thornburgh said better than any of us could. We've been a leader for so long. We can do better. National requirements regarding monitoring procedures are limited. If you know the ADA and Title III, we say that there should be access, but in order to often gain access, which we're looking at comparing to Egypt now, if we want to get access, we often have to sue. To what extent can we get out of this box of individuals' rights and litigation and learn from the human rights practices that are included in the convention? We have much to teach the world, yes, but we also have much to learn. And I just want to end with a wonderful quote from a letter that you all got today, which I hope we will copy and send, that Eric prepared, because I think he also says it better than I could. These human rights violations must be brought to an end. By signing the UN Disability Rights Convention, the United States will demonstrate its commitment to the recognition and enforcement of the rights of people with disabilities. And in joining the list of nations that support the convention, we will put countries on notice that they can and will be held accountable for violations of the rights of people with disabilities, including the country of the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. It's always hard to follow Eileen, but I want to say that I think Tara did give us a beautiful roadmap, and I'd like to follow up on both Tara and Arlene's comments to talk about some practical aspects of implementing the convention here in this country. And I'd like to start off by saying I am we can work with this. I am not a lawyer. I'm probably the only person that's not a lawyer on this panel, so this will not be a very lolly discussion, if that's a word. Anyway, as one of the positives of the disability rights movement in this country, there have been a number of disability-led organizations that have become very strong and have really impacted the lives of people with disabilities, both, I would say, in this country and around the world. Most of the disability-led organizations in the U.S. focus on local issues. Unfortunately, there are too few of us, and most of us are here today, that focus on international issues. And I represent the World Institute on Disability, and we work on both local and international issues. And I want to talk about how our international work has really impacted our local work and how I really believe that that's significant with regard to implementing the convention. And when we discuss practical strategies for implementing the convention, how we utilize disability-led organizations in this country, including independent living centers, and also how we utilize our allies. Arlene used the word allies, and it's my personal belief that the disability community, at least in this country, has been sort of moving away from the idea of utilizing allies. And I think in order for this convention to be successful in this country and throughout the world, we have to start ramping up our connection with women's groups and other human rights organizations that are working for the human rights of all around the world. The World Institute on Disability is based in Oakland, California. Yes, we are from the left coast. And I would say that our role has been really as kind of an informal international broker, focusing on, I'm going to talk about three areas. I'm going to talk about the women's work we've done, Disability World, which is our international webzine, and the just kind of how that has spawned other projects, and then our Access to Assets project, asset development project. So we've really been it's been around for about 20 years, but really I think our significant international work has occurred in the last 12 to 15 years. And our focus has been to develop effective practice in key policy areas and involve people with disabilities at all levels of developing and implementing the practice. The example I want to give is the example of women with disabilities. As many of you know, the women with disabilities were a very big part of the 1995 Women's Forum in China. I think it was called the Fourth World Conference on Women? And I don't know if Tina was there.
No.
Okay, well, a number of us were there, and a number of us discovered how inaccessible things were and made ourselves very, very well known to the leaders of the event. But in so doing, we discovered that there were over 200 women there, and we really wanted to capture how those women got there. So we interviewed them and wrote a report. That report resulted in the 1997 International Leadership Forum for Women with Disabilities, organized by WID and a number of partners. One of the key organizers was in the room, Eileen Zeitzer. Rehabilitation International was involved, and that was an amazing event, which brought together 600 women from 80 countries and territories. The UN, through the ILO, was also a sponsor, and we had the support of 25 U.S. agencies, U.S. government agencies. It was essentially 5 days of networking and programming. That led to some technical assistance work done by WID and its partners with the ILO, the country of Namibia, Caribbean, Russia, China, and the most interesting part, or one of the most interesting parts for me, is it led to working with women back here in the U.S. from minority communities. That work was sponsored by the Social Security Administration and Department of Ed. Basically, we came full circle. You know, we really did begin working with minority women, which increased their understanding of disability and our understanding of issues faced by women of color in this country. In 2000, there was we had a collaborative team that organized a Beijing Plus Five. It was a UN-based intensive training and leadership development for young women with disabilities from 30 countries. And many of the women trained at these events became leaders in their country's support of the UN Disability Rights Convention. I would say one of the things that we're most proud of is these women began training initiatives in their countries, and then in 2002, WID and RI and a number of folks organized a women's side event at one of the first UN ad hoc committee meetings, I couldn't remember which one it was, it was a women's side event to gather research and information to support a separate article pertaining to women and girls. And the main result of that side event was that Germany and Korea funded research with WID project support that basically launched a discussion for that, sorry, it's hard to read Braille when the tablecloth is part of the action. It ultimately resulted in passing that article. I want to briefly talk about Disability World as a tool. Disability World is an award-winning international disability periodical or a webzine published 26 issues between 2000 and 2007. The involvement of writers and advocates from more than 20 countries resulted in an exchange of practical and up-to-date information on, I think, some particular issues that hadn't been given in-depth treatment, at least on an international level, in a consistent way. That would include women and youth. Of course, there were papers put out, but what Disability World was able to do was kind of consistently allow people to comment, react, write articles in a very consistent manner. And then the other issue that I think was dealt with very well there was how to use the media, just using the media. And also the evolution of the independent living movement and how it's being shaped by different cultures, both around the world and in this country. A main topic that Disability World really helped explore was the issue of disability and governance and how people with disabilities were becoming elected or appointed to parliaments and influential government positions. The results were the first international workshop held in South Africa and Norway, enabling some amazing interchange between politicians and policymakers with a wide variety of disabilities. Then we conducted interviews with, I think it was like 25 selected politicians from Africa, Europe, and North America, and the publication of the first international study of governance and disability. And I will say that our main contributor to the report, Eileen Zeitzer, I hope is still in the room, because without her, it would never have happened. Another area that WID, all right, now I'm screwed. I'll just give up the braille. sometimes it just, one thing that the women's work did for us is when we worked in the minority communities, we just saw the need for the bridge to be built between the disability community and the African American community or the Latino community. And that really inspired us because of our work in Central America and Mexico to work with the Latino community in this country. So my point about, you know, practical strategies for implementing the convention is that the skills that many of us have gotten globally can certainly work locally and impact people in this country. And I'm talking about immigrants as well as US citizens who come from countries that are not that don't have the extensive disability service delivery system that we have. Another area that we've cut, 5 minutes, all right. Another area that WID is working very intensely in, and when I say WID, WID is a collaborative agency. We've worked with MDRI, we've worked with a number of, with folks at the Burton Blatt Institute. We do everything in collaboration. There's not one international project that we've ever done alone. But the idea of microloans and women getting out of poverty or folks or anti-poverty programs has really never been explored in the area of disability. And we were inspired in Ethiopia by some work that the ILO was doing at getting disabled women to work. And so a few years back, we started researching it at WID and discovered that there is an entire movement out there, a poverty reduction movement designed for women who were getting off welfare in the 90s that helped them develop assets and taught them financial literacy and helped, you know, teach them how to save money. And we thought at WID, well, why aren't people with disabilities a part of this? Because they are definitely the poorest of the poor. And why aren't women with disabilities involved in these programs? So WID has been, along with another, WID has been spearheading really the movement to get disability, to build bridges between the asset development community and the disability community. And we have a number of partners in that community or in that work as well, including National Disability Institute and the folks at the University of Iowa. So these are just three projects or three areas where the global has impacted the local and vice versa. And I think when we do develop our strategy, we of course will honor the process that's set forth in how to implement human rights treaties in this country. But I just really want to we've got to keep disability-led organizations like WID, like the National Council on Independent Living, AAPD, MDRI, at the center of this. And I think that that we all have experience that's very valuable. And I just want to, again, say that, you know, the practical aspects, kind of where the rubber meets the road of implementation are really, as you will agree, very critical. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Tina.
Sorry, just trying to... whatever. I think I want to start by just saying that for me it's interesting to be here. This is about maybe a little less than 2 weeks after the signing ceremony. The signing ceremony marked the end of the major part of the international level process, and this marks the beginning in the U.S. of our domestic process to really see what we're going to do with this convention. I want to reiterate something what Kathy said and also what my colleague Maria Veronica Reyna from the IDC said this morning about this convention is really being owned by people with disabilities. The convention was the majority was written by people with disabilities in one way or another. The International Disability Caucus, in which I was also one of the participants, was, I call it that the IDC was an unofficial negotiating partner. Of course, we weren't a negotiating partner, but our opinion mattered. If there were things that the IDC said, we cannot live with this to be in the text, that was recognized, and things that we were absolutely opposed to did not come into the text. It was very important for people with disabilities, mostly through our representative organizations on the international, regional, and national levels, to be the ones that created the human rights norms that are now going to be applied to our situations. That has to continue in the national process of implementation. And I think there's a role for all partners. As Kathy said, we need our allies, but the process has to be like the IDC was, one that respects and upholds the leadership of disabled people's organizations on our own issues. That's all the least we can ask for as a measure of respect for ourselves and for our human rights. And that's also what is mandated by Article 4.3, is consultation with people with disabilities through their representative organizations. So I would really hope that we can take the IDC in particular as a model for building a national coalition that can work on ratification and implementation and monitoring. I also want to speak in a funny way for me. I feel as an American, this convention is an opportunity for us. Our country has experienced, is experiencing many wounds and very deep divisions. I think that all sides would say that they uphold the values of individual freedoms and social solidarity, but they just may disagree about what those things mean. I think the conservatives and the liberals, the right and the left, would all say that they uphold these kinds of values. But what do they mean? This convention is an opportunity for us to explore some of the relationship between individual freedom and social solidarity and try to give new meaning to those values for everyone. And it's for people with disabilities and for American society as a whole. In a lot of ways, the issue that I'm going to try and speak about in some detail, supported decision making and legal capacity, that's maybe the essence of what this means, the relationship between individual freedom and social solidarity, because we're talking about instead of the model of legal capacity where you restrict a person's right to make decisions for themselves. You say, this person can't make very good decisions because of a disability, therefore, we're not going to allow them to make decisions anymore. Somebody else has to do it. Instead of that, we're saying, let's not restrict the person's individual freedoms. Let's surround the person with the support that can help them benefit from other people's assistance to make decisions for themselves. And support is not supposed to say, we're going to do it for you. It's not surrounding in the sense of smothering, but surrounding in the sense of solidarity to give the person the opportunity to use the resources they have, and the person still has the freedom to make their own choices and to make their own mistakes. I want to give a couple of examples from real life of people with psychosocial disabilities. Not everyone identifies with that term, but people who have been part of the anti-psychiatric abuse or community of psychiatric survivors. There's one woman who I will mention by name because she's passed away, and she passed away under circumstances that were constituted a human rights violation. My friend Ellen Glick, who was an activist in New York City, who founded one of the first organizations of people with psychosocial disabilities in New York City, she died on the operating table from constipation that was induced by a neuroleptic drug that she was being forced to take against her will. And she was under what's called outpatient commitment, where instead of locking people up in institutions, which is also still done, but sometimes instead of putting you in an institution, they just dictate every aspect of your life by a court order that some psychiatrist and judge feel they think they know what's best for you. So my friend Ellen had to open her home to mental health professionals who she didn't want to have any relationship with. She was forced to take this drug that ended up resulting in her death. And she was miserable. She had enough misery in her life. She was already miserable because she was estranged from her children. She did become suicidal at times. There were times when she was not good at taking care of herself. There were times that people would say that she's running out into the street. They have to protect her from being run over. But I want to ask two questions in relation to this. Would it have been better or worse for her to die living in freedom than for her to die the way she did, enslaved to psychiatry? And what kind of supports can we give people? How can we really help people live meaningfully, to live the way that they want to live? Not by making somebody's pain into an occasion for punishment. I'm going to give one other example that also related to Ellen. I once visited her when she was locked up in a psychiatric ward. She was being injected with a neuroleptic drug called Abilify against her will. And it made her vomit constantly. The psychiatrist came into her room, and I asked the psychiatrist, why are you doing this to her? Because it was obvious the physical misery that she was in. The psychiatrist said, we're doing this to get her to take risperidone, which is another neuroleptic. Now, I see that as a classic instance of torture. You don't have to go through any fancy analysis to see that this is intentional infliction of pain and suffering for the purpose of coercion. So it's not only something that goes on in institutions in faraway parts of the world, it's happening right here. And this is just an example of one person whose memory I want to remember. And I want to say also, Ellen Glick was a pain in the butt. Thanks. I remember her as a friend, and I also remember her as someone who made lots of annoying phone calls. I'm sure all her friends remember her the same way. And we have to find ways to embrace, as communities, the people who are pains in the butt instead of locking them up and forcing them to take drugs they don't want. So it's easier for communities to say, well, you know, we're taking care of her. We have to learn to interact with each other. We have to learn our own resilience in dealing with people who we consider pains in the butt. Because somebody might consider any of us a pain in the butt at the same time. I'm going to go into some explanation of supported decision making and legal capacity, or supported decision making as a model for legal capacity, because I know it's not familiar to a lot of people. Supported decision making is an alternative to guardianship and substituted decision making. It's not a single model necessarily, but an approach to legal capacity that's based on inclusion of people with disabilities rather than exclusion, because mostly the way we understand legal capacity, it's either or. Either you have legal capacity or someone says, I don't think you're doing so well at making decisions, you do not have legal capacity. It's based on the principle that every person has a will and is capable of making choices, and that autonomy can coexist with interdependence. And I'm going to quote from a paper by a colleague of mine, Mats Jespersen, in Sweden. The social model of disability says that the problem is not within the individual, but in the society, which does not meet this person in such a way that he or she can function. This applies also to problems with legal capacity. It's not a problem inside the individual, which should be met by forced intervention or guardianship, but society must relate in another way to this person so that his or her disability regarding legal capacity diminishes. So we're just talking about the application of what we all understand as the social model of disability to this situation of legal capacity, where for the most part it really hasn't been applied before. There are some countries that have started to implement various parts of supported decision making, but it hasn't been fully implemented everywhere to the point of doing away with guardianship. Okay, so supported decision making is an example of the social model. If people have a difficulty to express and communicate their wishes, the solution is not to put in a guardian, but to develop a relation and ways that make it possible for the person to express and communicate what the person wants. Supported decision making is based on a relationship of trust. And it's been pointed out that even if a person cannot use language, even if the disability is so significant or of such a nature that the person cannot use language, spoken or signed language, the person can still establish trusting relationships. And that's an insight that was developed by people with intellectual disabilities and their families and supporters. Support can be simple or complex. A person might need some very simple assistance with information in signing contracts or making healthcare decisions. Or a person might need support in making decisions and communicating their will in every aspect of life. Support requires patience and respect for the person's own style and process of making decisions. So when a person when a person has that kind of disability that the person does not speak or sign, there are many other ways to express feelings and desires. Those providing support need to be very attentive to cues that indicate likes and dislikes, and there must be safeguards to ensure that providers of support do not overrule the will of the individual with a disability. So this is in the convention. Article 12 guarantees legal capacity to people with disabilities on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. There's also a positive obligation to provide access to the support people may need in exercising their legal capacity, and these measures must respect the rights, will, and preferences of the person. So people with disabilities have the same rights, freedoms, and responsibilities as others, and assistance is provided without undermining autonomy, dignity, or personhood. I'm just going to say a couple of the steps to implementation. So transforming guardianship to supported decision-making, what does that mean? And this is just one way to think about it. Amend guardianship laws so that guardianship cannot be imposed against a person's will, and the person can choose who they want to have helping them make decisions. The guardian is required to respect the will and preferences of the person. And in that case, we really need to change the terminology. Does not become guardianship. It becomes something else. So you replace the term and concept of guardian with the concept of support person, because you're no longer making decisions for the person based on what you think is best. You are actually helping the person to make his or her own decisions. In addition, Article 12, along with other provisions in the convention, requires the repeal of coercive mental health laws, inpatient and outpatient commitment, all the laws and legal doctrines that would allow forced treatment of people who are labeled with a mental illness. As Arlene said, the convention doesn't differentiate or make any exceptions with regard to the right to free and informed consent, and similarly, it doesn't make any exceptions with equal legal capacity. Mental health services have to be provided on the basis of free and informed consent. Supported decision making in the mental health context will require independent advocates, because the mental health system is not in a position based on its history and people's history with it, to be providing that support. You need the independent peer advocates that have already been starting to happen. You need to explore alternative ways to deal with madness. I think in Europe, I'm not sure if it's here so much, there are networks of people who hear voices and talk about it as a positive thing, as something that can be beneficial and something that can be lived with, can be interacted with. It doesn't have to be seen as a symptom of an illness. And we need to explore diverse belief systems in that regard also. And I'll just close by saying people with psychosocial disabilities are members of communities. We need to look at shared risk and responsibility and the equal right to liberty and to live in the community. And I look forward to working with you all. Thank you.
Your notes can't reach all the way down. I'm sure of it.
Well, he's got my cane under the table.
Oh, Jesus. Knew there was a problem here. There are so many people that I feel that I need to thank for this conference coming together today, but the list is too long and my time is too short. So to all of you, you know who you are, and so I'll just say it that way. How's that? It's a pleasure to be talking kind of from a stepping back for a second from an international human rights perspective. I am not well versed in disability rights advocacy. I was not a member of any working group, and in some ways I am free because I am also not a diplomat, as I have warned some people around here. But many already know that. But that said, I believe that this treaty, with or without the U.S. ratification, holds great promise for advocates for disability rights in the United States and for human rights in the United States, not only for the reasons that have been talked about by others this morning, but with a growing movement paying attention to and advocating for human rights, situating social justice struggles, whether for economic and social rights or for traditional civil rights within a human rights framework, there's growing awareness of the importance and effectiveness of international standards, treaties, and evolving norms in this country. The new UN Convention for the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is one such new norm, or actually it's a series of norms, and one which can be used effectively by activists throughout the US and throughout the world. I'm going to talk about three or four. I've crossed it out several times during the course of this panel, so I haven't quite decided. Three or four. Main things in the short time allowed. What kind of strategies has the U.S. government undertaken to limit the effectiveness of U.N. human rights treaties in their domestic application? A cautionary note as we move forward this afternoon in our strategy discussion, and for advocates pushing for ratification. Two, which we may or may not get to, why does the international human rights treaty system matter in the United States, particularly when the U.S. plays such a limited role in it? Three, how the treaties which have been ratified by the U.S. have been used effectively as advocacy and organizing tools, including in U.S. courts. And four, useful strategies that have been adopted by activists in the U.S. using human rights treaties that the U.S. has not yet ratified, like CEDAW or the Convention for the Rights of the Child. This might give us some ideas for using the new Disability Rights Convention even before the U.S. signs and ratifies this treaty. Of course, I only have a few minutes, so I'll be very brief, but we'll be happy to go into more detail in the discussion period, both minutes that we'll have for discussion. The United States has an ambivalent, and some may say schizophrenic, I don't mean that in any loaded way, relationship to international human rights treaties. While the U.S. until recently has had a reputation as the key promoter and protector of human rights around the world, the U.S., as has been mentioned earlier, has only ratified three of the major U.N. human rights treaties: the Convention Against Torture, Inhumane and Degrading Treatment of Punishment, CAT; the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, CERD; and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. This means that the United States has not ratified treaties like CEDAW, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, although 185 other countries have ratified it. It means, even worse, that the U.S. has not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, a treaty that every other country in the world except Somalia has ratified. We should be very proud. It's also important to note at the outset that while the U.S. has ratified three of the seven, now eight, major human rights treaties, where they have ratified the treaty, they've done so by also placing substantial reservations, understandings, and declarations on the treaties. RUDs, as they're called, are meant to limit or redefine a country's obligations under the treaty. And it's very important to be aware of this as we push for ratification of the new Disability Rights Convention. While to be permissible, these reservations cannot undermine the object or the purpose of the treaty, sorry for getting pretty legalistic, the truth is the treaty monitoring bodies are fairly lax at allowing RUDs that may do just that. The U.S. has developed a set of several strategies that it's effectively used to undermine many of its international human rights obligations. Most commonly, the U.S. attaches a declaration at the time of ratification of human rights treaties which states that, quote, the United States declares that the provisions of Articles X through Z, 1 through 3,000, of the Convention are not self-executing. This means that although the Constitution declares that treaties ratified by the Senate are the supreme law of the land, with the non-self-executing declaration, treaties don't have the force of domestic law, and domestic implementation will require separate legislation. This also means that there can be no legal cause of action for implementation independently under the treaty. You can't just march into court and say, my rights under this treaty have been violated, and therefore I deserve relief. Some say that the non-self-executing clause ensures that new rights are endorsed by both houses of Congress through traditional legislative process rather than, excuse me, rather than the unicameral ratification process that the advice and consent function of the Senate would serve. But the truth is that implementing legislation is rarely ever passed. You've heard some say already today that and the argument is often made that the rights are already protected under U.S. law. So we can ratify this treaty, but we really don't need to pass any implementing legislation because we already have the ADA. If you look at the Disability Rights Convention, it is much broader than the ADA. It goes far beyond that. It has proactive obligations for the state. And so any argument that says, we're okay, we already have it, doesn't go far enough. This is something that may become particularly noteworthy with the new Disability Rights Convention, as the arguments are made that the ADA and other pieces of legislation cover the rights enshrined in the new convention. The second major understanding with the U.S. that the U.S. always attaches to its ratification of human rights instruments is a federalism understanding. This states that the covenant shall be implemented by the federal government to the extent that it exercises legislative and judicial jurisdiction, and otherwise by the state and local governments. The federal government shall take measures appropriate to the federal system to the end that state or local governments may take appropriate measures for the fulfillment of the covenant. We don't have time to go into this in depth because it's a very complicated question, but basically it shifts responsibility and says, we're going to do what we can on the federal level, but hey, the states are the states. States' rights, what are we going to do? And it complicates the implementation of these treaties. I have to take note with great respect to Steve, my good friend Steve, who I warned I was going to do this to. I do believe that the U.S. government takes seriously its commitments to human rights treaties. They show up at the UN when the U.S. is under review for its treaty obligations. They respond to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. They may not actually implement any of the decisions of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, but they do show up, and they put a lot of time and effort into their arguments. When Stephen said earlier today that some of the reasons behind the U.S. not signing immediately this treaty were that there needs to be a thorough examination of the treaty so that it can be implemented right away, that the states need to be able to apply it directly, and that we won't become a party until all of our domestic law is in order, I have to take great issue with pretty much all three points. That has not been our experience. It's good. There's someone blocking Steve, so we can't see each other. It's good. No, don't move. That has not been the case for any of the other human rights treaties that have been ratified by the United States. We do not have implementing language and implementing legislation for any of the other three human rights treaties except partial legislation for CERD, the Convention on Racial Discrimination. If this were the threshold test for us to actually join one of these treaties, that would be fabulous. But our country would look quite different than it does today. So with due respect. So why does the international human rights treaty system matter to the United States? Again, very briefly, as we think about strategy, as we think about using this treaty, it expands the legal framework available. It provides additional forums in which to advocate. It takes us out of just litigating ADA claims in the courts of the United States, but brings us into an oversight committee of the United Nations. It enables us to work with coalitions internationally that can create targeted international and strategic pressure that can make a difference in our own domestic advocacy in this country. Carefully. International perspectives can empower and bring momentum to local activists as it has been done in many, many types of issues using these human rights treaties. In particular, the case of the Western Shoshone people, who have used the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination very effectively in their claims against the U.S. government on land claims. And they've used these international instruments in creative and great ways. They have not had their problems solved yet, but they have used it very effectively. And finally, it brings these issues to the attention of a different set of decision makers, which is very important as well. I want to spend just a moment talking about effective advocacy and organizing around the already ratified UN human rights treaties. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has made efforts, great efforts, and not small efforts, to get up to date with its treaty reporting obligations for those three treaties that the U.S. has ratified already. Civil society groups in the U.S. have seized this opportunity to organize in an unprecedented way, to use these reporting periods to intervene with the treaty monitoring body, to submit shadow reports, also known as supplemental reports, to the committees which aim to fill in the gaps or to correct information in the state party reports, just in the event that they might be a little off from what civil society thinks is really happening, and to attempt to hold the U.S. accountable for its real lack of implementation of these treaty provisions. When the U.S. does eventually ratify the new convention, the work of the coalitions that have formed in recent years provide an excellent model for activism to show the potential of what can be done. In the case of CAT, the torture convention, a coordination effort started with a very short time frame. They created a set of working groups and brought in a bunch of NGOs working on issues that were relevant to the issues covered in CAT, which prepared some collaborative reports in an ad hoc way. And a group went to Geneva, advocated in front of the committee, and came back with some pretty good language from their concluding recommendations. But they learned through this short process that they had and set up a very sophisticated and very comprehensive and very exhausting process in the case of the ICCPR. It is a long and broad treaty with 27 substantive articles, which now has been totally put to shame by the new UN Disability Rights Convention with its really short, little, tiny articles. I'm glad I'm not going to coordinate a shadow report on that one. But 141 organizations and individuals ultimately worked together to develop a coordinated, collaborative shadow report, which was sent to the 18 Human Rights Committee members. The report was derived from 21 working groups, which came together to cover a wide range of substantive issues relevant to the treaty. The groups worked for approximately 8 months to coordinate what wound up to be a 500-page shadow report with a very strong executive summary section and key advocacy priorities. An unprecedented delegation of more than 60 activists went to Geneva to lobby the committee members during their review. I have 2 minutes. The key things that we learned in that process were that coordinated advocacy, clear priorities, consistent messages, media strategies, both in Geneva and at home, and follow-up activity were key. Tina Minkowitz, who's on this panel today, was a key activist in the ICCPR process and can talk at more length about that. A process is underway now for coordination around the reporting to CERD, which is anticipated to come out this spring. The process holds great hope for the disability rights community. I'm going to skip to just say that, as Tara said, it's all of our responsibilities to implement this treaty. The last thing I wanted to just note is the usefulness of the human rights instruments that have not been yet ratified by this country, and efforts that have been made on the local level to promote the use and adoption of these treaties on a local, state, or regional level. Just a few quick examples. In San Francisco, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women has been adopted by the City and County of San Francisco and is law within that city. I, of course, am very proud of that since I'm from San Francisco, but had nothing to do with it. But not only did they adopt it as a city and county-wide ordinance, but a commission was set up to review implementation, and money was put behind it to ensure its implementation and to ensure that there was a review for every city office in terms of the city's compliance with the CEDAW measures. There are similar initiatives underway in New York, the New York Human Rights Initiative, which is seeking to combine CEDAW and CERD principles to implement in New York City. There are other efforts afoot in Massachusetts in a similar way. Remember that the U.S. has not ratified CEDAW. There's been the use of treaties that the U.S. I know it's time. That the U.S. has not yet ratified in court documents to try to bring the law of nations into arguments where treaties have been widely adopted in other countries or by other countries to show customary international norms. Finally, it's important to know that there are many strategies that can be used. Mobilizing affected communities, as has been discussed by others, using local human rights commissions, using the existence of this treaty now as a basic opportunity for education about these newly existing international norms and standards. If you walk into a room and say, the international community says, here are the rights of disabled persons, and X number of countries has signed on to this, 80 countries at least at this point, it's a very strong message. And it shifts the way that you may be able to talk about the human rights of people with disabilities. So I have a long list here. My time is up, and thank you.
When I was in the associate dean's office, my arm was a lot longer. We do have a few minutes available for questions and maybe some answers. I also want to alert you to the fact that the lunch is in the next room, but the plan is for you to get your lunch in that room and come back into this room because there is a lunchtime speaker, R.A. Nair. So once we finish the question and answer, we'll go and do that and try to manage that part of the process. So try to get back to here so we can hear from our speaker. But we do have some time for questions.
And Bob, just one logistical announcement. That we do have some student conference hosts who are here to help maneuver for anybody that needs assistance carrying their buffet plate back to the table, and so they can provide whatever assistance is needed. And they won't eat your lunch on their way back. They better not.
Any questions? I know that everybody's with lunch hour pending, this is probably a perilous task, and anybody who asks a question has to look at his or her colleagues and wonder why they're taking time. But we do really have a few. Tara?
Just a comment. The nonprofit.
Okay. You're right there, yeah.
You know what? I think it's this one.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's on.
A comment. I think we've often looked at the non-self-executing execution doctrine as a real barrier to implementation. And I think it would be good for us to turn it around and look at it the other way, in the sense of a real opportunity to make these conventions real in our local communities. And so work at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level to turn these broad guarantees into something that's really relevant for us here. So I think that we should try to change the way we look at that and say, this is the way that we entrench human rights in the United States. And we may do it slightly differently than some other places, but let's embrace this. It's our reality, and let's embrace it and use it in a positive way.
Anyway,
I always say that human rights activists are the most optimistic people in the world because we have to be. And I think that is a very, very important point. The history hasn't been so positive with this, but I think if we turn it on its head and really embrace it this way, and especially with the new beginning of this really remarkable treaty, there are great opportunities, particularly because so many of the people who are advocating are from locally based organizations. It provides us with a completely different kind of opportunity and clear constituencies who are going to be able to affect policies on the ground.
I wanted to say that one thing that is happening, I know, for example, the city of Santa Cruz has passed a resolution to encourage the government to sign and ratify the treaty, but there is discussion, I think, both in San Francisco and Berkeley to do the same thing with the Disability Rights Convention that San Francisco did with CEDAW. Yeah.
And for those who are local, we have Tacoma Park, so I think we have some possibilities for local adoption. Any other questions or observations? If not, then I think we're ready for lunch. I want to thank the panel for a wonderful set of presentations.